So as we wrap up, what needs to be done right now? What is your assessment of what Liberia is doing, and what can the U.S. do?
Well, first of all, you know, that's a 15-year-old is not a young man, but a child. And, you know, that just is an awful way to respond, even if he had been. It doesn't matter how old, but, you know, shooting a child who then dies of the injury, right? So hypothermic shock and bleeding just means, you know, he died of his gunshot wound, of course. And, you know, anything on that side of the response is not smart. It's not humane. It's not going to work. On the other hand, you know, you have the response I mentioned, Last Mile Health, and who work with the public sector. It's not like we're saying, you know, NGOs, you know, these are people working with local authorities in Kano District to build a completely different kind of response, which is, let's have community health workers help us find the patients. Let's have proper care for the patients, and let's find everything we can to get them better and prevent spread in that way. And that's what we should all be focused on right now. And there's, you know, there's no reason we can't stop this with the adequate investment in again, staff, stuff, systems right now.
And the health workers on the front line in these countries now, what they're going through?
I was in Connaught Hospital with colleagues of mine from England, from King's College, and you know, looking around the hospital, they're getting ready to set up an Ebola ward.
This is in Sierra Leone.
I'm just thinking, what a tragedy! What's about to happen to them? Because they just, you know, no wonder the health workers are frightened, right? They know they don't. People know that they don't have the personal protective equipment that they need. They know that they don't have what it would take to, you know, treat people with dignity and compassion. And, you know, it's a very frightening thing. I've lived through, you know, situations like that. And, you know, the earthquake in Haiti, when you know you just don't have what you need to help people survive. And it's frightening, you know, and it's demoralizing.
5 seconds. That note, we want to say thank you so much to Dr. Paul Farmer, infectious disease doctor, medical anthropologist, founder of Partners in Health, professor at Harvard Medical School. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Fell, Sarah Mate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Afa, Fani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzzer.
This is KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Positively Revolting right after this.
KBOO is preparing for a legendary book and record sale happening on Sunday, September 14th at the Volunteers of America building, 537 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. We're accepting donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs, VHS, and cassette tapes, and all donations are tax deductible. Your discards are another person's treasure, and all sales benefit your community radio station, KBOO. So bring those donations down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. For more information, please contact Jesse, 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. That's the annual book and record sale on Sunday, September 14th.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor
Negative Land.
Performing live Friday, August 29th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland.
We got so much power.
How many time zones there are in the Soviet Union?
Since 1980, Negative Land has been creating records, CDs, video, fine arts, books, radio, and live performance using appropriated sounds, images, objects, and text.
Negative Land will be performing with Daniel Mensch and Cascadian Knights. All ages welcome.
Not even funny.
Again, that's Negative Land, Friday, August 29th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The loudspeaker spoke up and said,
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the release party for the Sexbots' new EP, Songs for Jamil. The release party will be held September 13th at The Rose, 111 Southwest Ash Street, 9 p.m. This is a 21 and over venue. The Sexbots play cross-genre electronica, melding hip-hop beats from international collaborators with spoken word, odd samples, and a classically trained violinist turned indie vocalist. Again, that's the release party for the Sexbots' new EP, Songs for Jamil. September 13th at The Rose, 111 Southwest Ash Street at 9 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm, on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
Good morning. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. And this is absolutely revolting. Normally a show run by two excellent women. And I'm just the guest host. My name's Joe Uris. I'm sitting in until they return in a couple of weeks. But, you know, things are going on. I need your calls, 231-8187. And I didn't think I'd have to do this again, but we're going to have to talk about Ferguson, Missouri. We're going to have to talk about the murder. And I want to make this very clear, the murder of Michael Brown. And we're going to have to talk about the cover-up already underway of that murder, because it's very, very interesting. The New York Times on Wednesday ran two stories side by side on the front page in the upper right-hand corner. That's considered the big news slot. Essentially arguing that there are two versions of what happened in the killing of Brown. And this got a lot of people very, very upset. And the Times used that to argue that there needs to be a better inquiry than is apparently planned on the killing in Ferguson. I want to talk about the structural issues involved. I want to talk about the way in which this is all being covered. And I want to talk about the history of the way in which African-Americans have been treated in general in an area we have, most of us here on the coasts, ignored, focusing too often and exclusively on the South or on cities which with which we are familiar. Because there are a lot of structural issues and a lot of issues that are not apparently based on or have a construct within which racism is flourishing. First of all, let's be clear about what's going on here. Michael Brown may or may not have been stoned on marijuana. Michael Brown may or may not have stolen some cigars. Michael Brown, in fact, may or may not have had a physical altercation with the officer who later murdered him. Those events that I just said may or may not have taken place are irrelevant to the question of his murder. We have three, so far, witnesses, one or two of which actually have video, showing that Michael Brown was killed without being in any way threatening directly to the officer who killed him. We know this. We know this from every source we have, except for, and this is where the New York Times comes in, essentially some kind of ghost witnesses, people who don't seem to exist, who suggest another version of events. Now, the fact that the New York Times, very differently than in many, many cases, actually gave those witnesses, the ghost witnesses, the non-physical witnesses, credibility is extremely, extremely disturbing. Enough so that I feel like I need to revisit this. I can't let it go. The killer is a police officer, Darren Wilson. And the DA, Robert McCulloch, who is going to be holding the review of this through both the process of grand jury and other investigations, is of a law enforcement family. In fact, he wanted to be a policeman. His mother, his whole family are people coming out of the police tradition. And he himself couldn't become a policeman because he had a loss of a leg. He became a district attorney. Now, normally, we expect district attorneys in any venue to be law enforcement oriented. That's not strange. But what is strange here is that this guy, who has this close association with law enforcement in a situation which is uniquely challenging of the behavior of law enforcement in Ferguson, insists that he will be the district attorney to examine the case. He will not step down. The governor, who is a mild Democrat, will not ask him to step down. The whole situation is tinged with the worst kind of politics, and the confusion in the public mind, and actually I had a caller on one of the two shows I do, I can't remember, talking about, hey, kids walking down the middle of the street, blah, blah, blah. Look, we need to make some distinctions here. It is not relevant to the murder that this kid may or may not have stolen some cigars. It is not relevant to the murder, even that he may or may not have had a strange altercation with the police officer prior to his being killed. What is relevant is that he was not a danger to the officer. He was not in any way a person deserving of capital punishment. This is really serious. There are many questions. Why was backup not called for? Why was a taser not used? Why? And so on and so on. I think really of central importance here is the implicit racist assumption that the black community in Ferguson, members two-thirds African-American, the assumption that it is a wild place that is deserving of the worst kind of, essentially, even though it's a law enforcement shooting, vigilante justice. And I am more and more disarmed by the way in which both the New York Times and others are trying to create some kind of fairness, I put quotes around that word, about the case. It's obvious what happened. It's obvious that this person was killed for no particular reason. Many alternatives existed. And it's obvious that the appearance of fairness on the part of the DA cannot be achieved in this context. Any reasonable state government, any reasonable district attorney, in fact, would recuse themselves because they have clear conflicts of interest. So that's, I mean, I just wanted to get that out there because that really bothers me, really upsets me. And I'm not sure people are thoughtful enough to recognize the difference between whether or not this young man was behaving badly prior to being shot, whether or not he stole something prior to being shot, and whether or not his execution in the street and the following 4 hours or more that his body lay on the street without any examination, the police car, which was evidential because of fingerprints, disappeared. All of that creates, in my mind, a cover-up and a disinterest or an indifference to the life of this 18-year-old young man. So there's where I'm coming from, and I think I'm right, in fact, I know I'm right, and I really don't understand any other kind of argument. But apparently we, all of us, can't separate out the question of his possible misbehavior, his possible criminal activity, I say possible, the fact that he was on marijuana at the time, apparently, none of that should have any relevance to his murder. And I just don't get it. I am completely confused and lost about our response to all of this. Because I see in all of policing two things going on simultaneously, and then a third thing I want to talk about uniquely St. Louis. I see, first of all, a militarization of police, which we saw following in the reaction of the community to the murder. We see an incredible militarization and an insane overreaction and overuse of chemical agents and all kinds of stuff. And then on top of that, I see a cover-up going on consciously, deliberately, on the part of some people in Ferguson, including, I have to say, the chief of police and the district attorney. So I want to know what your reactions to that are. I want to know how you are perceiving all of this. And I hope you'll give me calls on that, 231-8187. I think it's really important. There's some other issues. There's some other issues involved. The area around St. Louis has been divided into tiny municipalities, none of which has enough money to run good services, including well-trained police forces. Obviously, the overarching county government then takes on this responsibility, but obviously also not well. So I see both a structural situation in which disaster takes place, and I see an inherent assumption of racism. Most of us here on the coast, we don't pay a lot of attention. We see the South. We pay attention to murder in the South. We see the crime in New York, the Staten Island chokehold murder. We see murders in our own city. We see all of this, and we become concerned about police behavior. But we're not paying attention to the Midwest. We're not paying attention to St. Louis. We're not really appreciating the degree to which racism is endemic throughout much of the country. So I'd like to hear from you. 231-8187. Who do we have? John, you're on the air. John?
You hear me?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me?
Joe, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you, and thank you for taking on this topic.
Yeah.
Very briefly, I wanted to address very quickly the walking down the middle of the street, and I heard that gentleman call in on
yeah, I wish I hadn't cut him off so fast, because it was an interesting idea.
Well, here's the thing that I tried to do in all of these instances, is all that you need to do is to invert, is to switch it. So it's a black youth walking down the middle of the street. Make it a white person. You mm-hmm. can make it a white middle-aged person walking down the middle of the street.
Mm.
Would the same kind of negative characterization be applied in that instance? If it was a middle-aged white man walking down the middle of the street, would it then have been appropriate for the police to have shot him?
Well, yeah. Or try even this, because it's really perhaps the most ultimate inversion. Supposing it were a woman.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And the difficulty is that what that does is it forces one to actually examine one's the implicit bigotry that one may have, and that's difficult for people to do. But that's what I would urge upon that. I mean, growing up in this culture and watching the way that things have gone, I'm basically, in many ways, the way I would describe it is that really slavery never truly ended. I know that the functional aspect of slavery ended, but if you think about the prison industrial complex and the mass incarceration of the black population, in which they're then, you know, working for nothing, so maybe basically the racist tendencies of our nation have never really gone away.
No, they haven't, and I think your point is good. I think that we need to make a distinction between the vast and enormous injustice of slavery itself and the subsequent, particularly during Reconstruction and reaction to Reconstruction, beating down and removing of the rights of African Americans, and then the rise of a long-term struggle, which in the end culminated in the Civil Rights Movement and civil rights law. But these things, too, did not adequately change the situation of African Americans, particularly young African American men. And now that we're in a depression, they call it a grand recession, but it's a depression, we're seeing an enormous degree of unemployment among persons of color. In Ferguson, for example, more than 20% of the population, more than 20% of the population of eligible workers are unemployed. This means that there's an enormous number of restless young people. This means there's an enormous number of restless people, period. And it means, really, that people don't have a legitimate source of income. This is a very bad situation. Ronald Reagan, of all people, used to argue that you could have up to 20% of the population unemployed, kind of harsh, but beyond that, it would be a failure of the system. Well, this is a failure of the system in the Midwest.
Sure. The other thing, Joe, that I would actually urge people to do is one of the beauties of the time that we live in is things like YouTube. And I've gone back and reviewed some of the speeches of both Martin Luther King and of Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really important kind of thing, because what we wind up with is a filtered interpretation. And I think listening to the actual words of those gentlemen is an essential mind-clearing exercise. And when I was doing it, I realized the extent to which I had accepted the filtered interpretation of who these people were and the way that they had been presented in the media. And in particular, I had to confront my own acceptance of Malcolm X being described as unreasonable and militant. And when I actually listened to some of his speeches, I came away thinking, yeah, it's unreasonable and militant when you actually ask the system to behave in a decent manner, and that was mind-altering to me. And so I would recommend to the KBOO audience that refreshing your historical memory in that regard is a very valuable thing to do.
I agree with you. In fact, I've watched the public schools in their Black History Month and all that stuff, turn Malcolm X into the bad guy, too radical, too dangerous, too confrontive, too nationalist, etc., and watch them take Martin Luther King out of context and turn him into a very angelic figure because his struggle used the techniques of nonviolence. Well, remember that, and you know this, that the reason, probably the most important reason for the murder of Martin Luther King was that he made a public utterance against the war in Vietnam and talked about the radical nature of the oppression of Black people. And he was using nonviolent technique, which was an excellent technique for the situation, but he was by no means any less radical in a different sense than Malcolm X. And I really am glad you mentioned that people ought to look at those root documents.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Joe. And I know that I should go and let somebody else have a chance to speak.
Sure.
The one thing that I would mention, a comment on what you're saying that I deeply agree with, is because Martin Luther King was able to maintain his nonviolent stance, that in some sense gave him even more power to rattle, to confront the lack of morality and the actual lack of conscience of those whom he was facing. So I agree with you. And in an odd way, it's kind of like a moral jiu-jitsu that he performed upon his opponents, where because he did not stoop to their level, so he actually used them against themselves.
Yeah, he also understood something that I'm not sure would work in a more totalitarian environment, which is, you talk about moral jiu-jitsu, he actually was able to make clear the inherent violence of a structure that oppressed Black people throughout the nation.
Right.
Thank you very much for the call, man.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're talking about Ferguson. I was not really planning to revisit. We've done a lot of work on this, to revisit what's happening in Missouri. But I think it needs to be revisited after the New York Times published two front-page lead stories on Wednesday suggesting that there were two versions of what happened in Ferguson and ignoring the essential facts of the matter. And the most important essential fact is that an 18-year-old man walking down the middle of the street in defiance of a policeman was blown away, murdered, and left to lie there for more than 4 hours. That is really intolerable. That is really a reason for outrage, and that's why the community rose up. I think that the response then by the authorities of bringing in the highest tech, most violent police response is characteristic of an essentially racist society, whatever else we might think about it. And I'm going to, if I have time today, want to look at a more benign but equally weird thing, which is what has happened to Burning Man, a festival that I think is ultimately very cool. And we may or may not get to that, but I want to hear from you. 231-8187. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. So the indications are that the black guy was a bullying thug, a thief. He was stoned when he fractured the cop's eye socket. Now, if you don't think that stuff is relevant, you know, you're a really dangerous propagandist.
Okay.
Other than that, I like your show. You know what? Sean Hannity is obviously a shill for corporate fascism.
Okay.
But in regarding this circumstance, he's got it spot on. And thank God he's spreading the truth out there in regarding this matter.
Okay, thank you very. Is that it or more?
Yeah, I guess that's it.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. I think you're raising the very point I wanted to make. We do not yet know whether or not, in fact, that police officer was battered by his encounter initially in the streets of Ferguson. We have no witnessing beyond the officer himself. We don't know if indeed he was battered in this exchange. We do know that it was incredibly poor policing that took place at that moment. And we also know that there is a space of time between that exchange and the murder of the young man. I think it's really important to understand that the use of murderous force is inappropriate no matter how badly the police officer was battered, unless his life was directly threatened. And there's no evidence for that at all. There's distance between the officer in a car who could have called for backup, and he could have used a taser and so on. And there is the actual behavior of that officer in his number of shots, including shots essentially that had to have been fired after Michael Brown was falling to the ground. But I understand the anger at minimizing a possible role of Brown. But we're not going to, you know, we need to understand the distinction, the separation between the possible bad behavior, possible thuggery of Brown and the actual murder of Brown. And this is really important. If we don't have well-trained police, if they can't stop a man using superior force, not violence, then where are we in our policing in America? And the judgment of that officer is incredibly poor, assuming the Hannity version of it all. Anyway, I want to thank you for the calls. I do think that we cannot just dismiss the fact that Brown may or may not, and this is really important, have been a person who was not being nice. Is not being nice, is committing a petty crime of stealing cigars, of getting in a fight with a policeman, necessarily something that should lead to his being killed. I think not. I think that we have resources in any good, well-trained police force that can deal with this other than through the use of lethal force. Anyway, I want to hear from people. 231-8187. Sam, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Joe. I wanted to mention that let's assume for the moment that Mr. Brown had struck the officer and that Mr. Brown had, what was the other thing they said he might have done? Stolen cigars from a convenience store.
Right.
Those are specific offenses that have specific penalties spelled out in the law, none of which is summary execution. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. And I think the point that this caller made is really important. We have to separate out, we have to make a distinction clearly between the possible, and I want to emphasize the word possible, the rumored crimes of this man, Mr. Brown, and the consequence, possibly, of those crimes. To me, this is very clear. And I'm sort of surprised that there is a kind of, like, including the New York Times, a kind of effort to create the notion that somehow you can create a balanced approach by presenting both cases. Remember, other than the officer, there are no witnesses asserting what Brown allegedly did, and the video, of course, of him possibly stealing cigars. Anyway, I want to hear from you, and I want to bring up another thing that I oddly think is symbolic of the problems that we face in our society. Many of you may have gone to Burning Man. I think Burning Man is one of the coolest creative events of modern times. But in order to survive, it has essentially created a two-class system, or three classes. The creative people who make the event, you know, build the things that get burned and have performance and are very creative. The audiences of people who participate at some level, but in a lesser possibly way. And then a third element, the very wealthy dot-com and technology people who bring their big SUVs and so on and form compounds which exclude ordinary folk and hire people called Sherpas, ironically, who serve them in addition to the catering that's done, etc. And the creation of a two-class system at Burning Man, of all places, is so symbolic of the way in which our society is really broken into class structure. I think that's a really important point. Now, the problem for Burning Man was, how are we going to finance this? And the answer, of course, is to bring in the dot-com people who are hipper and cooler and so on, and then they can create their compound with their fancy RVs, and they have their Sherpas to do all the work for them, and they bring in fancy chefs and so on. And that division in that temporary community, I feel, is so symbolic of the way in which things are in our society. I think we really need to look at that. But that is another topic, essentially. There's no racial element to it, as far as I can tell. Mainly because, as far as I know, and I don't know a lot about it, Burning Man has nothing to do with race. Really doesn't. All right, let's hear from you. 231-8187. We're focusing in on what happened in Ferguson and the response to the killing of Michael Brown. Charlotte, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to mentioned that there is something wrong with the Sean Hannity and Fox News actually echo chamber, which has bled into the mainline media, mm-hmm. which is that yesterday it was found that an X-ray was done, and a lot of the injuries that are claimed publicly does not exist. There was no fracture. There was no serious damage. The only thing that we know about the police officer in Ferguson is that there was some swelling of it in his face.
So there was an exchange, a physical exchange, but no serious breakage.
There was no breakage, period. Okay. No serious breakage. There was no damage to the eye socket, as has been talked about, and the fracture that has been talked about. And as part of talking about these other ghost witnesses and stuff, I just wanted to focus on the point that this police department does not even have an incident report. An incident report does not even exist. And all we have are rumors and implications and stories of somebody who knows the policeman who is calling talk shows and then are described as witnesses and stuff like that. There's not there's not a real counter story, even, except for all of the rumors that are being thrown out there that are being treated as if they are a counter story. There's no there's actually no information that has ever been verified. In fact, it's only been rumors. There's not information.
I think you're making really a couple of good points.
The clearest information we have are eyewitness accounts with video that... That's part of the issue around, you know, what stories really are based on witnesses, real witnesses with facts that can be verified or not. And we don't even have, you know, when you don't even have the police story and everything is being held back so that the policeman can try to piece a story together that will try to sound real once he knows what all the other witnesses are saying. And so, I mean, these are real serious issues about whether or not there can be a fair trial, especially when the police chief and the DA who has actually tacked bringing in Ron Johnson, the trooper. He didn't like it that somebody from the outside was brought in and was critical of the governor doing that and thought that only the local police should be in charge of it.
Well, and
I'll let you go on, but I just wanted to bring up some of these issues around.
No, I appreciate your points.
What are the real facts in this case?
And I appreciate you reminding me of the term ghost witnesses, because that's what it amounts to. Thank you very much for the call. I also want to point out that let me be clear about the way in which grand juries work. In most states, in most circumstances, there are two ways that a person is charged with a crime. They go through a grand jury process, or the DA makes a true bill and then makes an accusation which goes to trial. Either of those is traditional. The other thing that is clear in this case is that the DA, coming out of a police family, being extremely biased, I believe his father was murdered in a police exchange, is not willing to recuse himself at all, takes it all very personally, and is going to allow the shooter, the murderer, I believe, Darren Wilson, to testify to the grand jury. It is unprecedented that a grand jury hears both sides of an argument when they're trying to decide whether or not to have a true bill against somebody. Normally, the procedure is that the state presents its case and argues that there's adequate reason to charge a person with a crime. It doesn't present the defense, and that's what's happening in Ferguson. Anyway, this all is very, very disturbing. It's all very, very weird. And in the meantime, we have the right-wing noise machine creating confusion, and crazily enough, the New York Times echoing that confusion. I want to hear from you and your thoughts on all of this. And I do want to hear from people who really feel that walking down the street, that possibly stealing cigars, that possibly having an altercation with the police, which apparently did not result in any broken bones, is reason for lethal force. 231-8187. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. Mac.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I would like to I'd like to point out, you know, you're talking, and it seems like, you know, you're trying to make it seem like you're objective.
No, no, I'm not objective.
You're saying these alleged facts that would point to anything positive to the officer, but yet anything that's negative, you say is fact. He is a murderer. What? I don't know. I'm a very reasonable person, mm-hmm. and I would expect that if I committed a crime, mm-hmm. if I had an interaction with an officer that ended in a physical altercation, mm-hmm. officer has gun on. He has a taser. He has lethal weapons. And if I were to attack that officer, what's to say I'm not going for the gun?
Well,
there are no witnesses.
Well, here's the problem.
We don't know what's happened, but yet
yeah.
everybody is so gripped that the officer is wrong.
Well, first of all, there are witnesses. There are three separate witnesses, one of which videotaped the event. And all of those witnesses give a similar, close enough to the same story to assume there is probably truth to it. And remember, the shooting. Wait, let me finish. Just let me finish. I'll let you. Hold on. Let me finish and then I'll let you talk. Remember that the shooting took place at some distance, and that there was no evidence that the victim was in any way at that moment endangering the police officer. Now go ahead.
And like you said, it's alleged, probably. So what I don't understand is why are people out rioting? Why nobody knows what really happened? And before anything gets sorted out, you have people destroying property and towns and peace. And it comes down to the basic fact. The kid had just done something criminal, and we don't know how much further that kid took that act. We don't know if he could have told that officer, I have a gun, I'm going to shoot you. We don't know. But it, so...
Well, we know he didn't have a gun. He didn't have any weapon.
Let me ask the question then. What right is it of anybody to form an opinion on far one side of the fence to the other? When you yourself are saying all the facts are in place, how dare you call the policeman a murderer? Because you don't know what happened. You are part of the problem spreading this propaganda. You know what? Maybe he did. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. Until we find out, how dare you stoke a fire one direction by calling him a murderer? You're not saying he could be a murderer. You are saying he is a murderer.
Yes, I am.
That's wrong. That's just straight wrong. You were not there.
No, I wasn't.
That kid could have made a move that made that officer fear for his life. And I'm a reasonable person. If I do something stupid and I get an altercation with a police officer, the last thing I'm going to be expecting is mercy if I make that officer feel threatened for his life. That's just idiocy. The police have a very hard job. I have family who are police, and they put themselves in danger every single day. So when somebody goes and does something wrong and then gets, you know, hey, if maybe he should have been tased, he should have been tased, but the kid shouldn't have put himself in the position in the first place. The officer didn't put himself in that position. The officer was out doing his job. He was out doing his job. The kid put himself in that position. And let's not forget, you screw up in life. You want to act like a criminal, you get treated like a criminal. And we don't know where that line will end.
Well, are you comfortable with executing? Wait a minute. I have an actual question for you.
Okay.
Since you're raising this in a kind of more profound way, do you believe that it is legitimate for the police to use lethal force when there's no direct threat?
Okay, let me ask you a question then. If you were a police officer and you had a firearm on your side, and that firearm could not only kill the person who's in front of you, that person in front of you got that firearm from you in a struggle, could kill you now.
But he didn't. That didn't happen. I mean, you're creating a ghost. There's no reality to what you just said. He didn't have a firearm. He was unarmed. Whatever he did wrong previous to getting shot, he was absolutely defenseless when he was blown away.
Really? That's why the police, if there was no altercation, there was no threat, that's why, you know, according to the facts that you want to sound here, these are, you know, the officer's face is all beaten up. I mean, let's just get real.
No, no. Well, look at the sequence of events. Look at the sequence of events and put yourself. No, I really need you to put yourself in the position of the police officer.
In a bad place. The officer did not put that kid in that place. He did not do that. And, you know, make no mistake. This isn't some honor student we're talking about that was walking down the sidewalk carrying an ice cream cone in his book bag home.
Okay.
This is a kid who just committed a crime. That is fact. So we know that this kid was in a criminal mentality. How much further had he taken that criminal mentality? We don't know. We weren't there. But yet you go and say, he's a murderer and he's this. Like you were there. Like you have all the facts. And that That is what is wrong with us. That's why people keep rioting. Not because people who are in positions of power to help ease a situation like this. You're not saying, hey, people, calm down. Let's get all the facts together. Let's see what we need to sort this out. No, you're stoking fires that you don't even need, nor need to be lit. That is an injustice right there. And I don't know what else to say. Until people who have power in radio and TV and all the media actually have a little more level head and say, hey, let's look at this and try to figure it out before we blow this up. Every single time we have an incident like this, it's going to be nasty. Because before we can really figure it out, you got people saying, blow up this, burn that, riot.
Whoa. Okay, first of all, I'm not advocating riot, and I'm not advocating disorder. I am talking about what happened in the street.
You are saying that policeman's a murderer?
Yes, I am.
There will be no justice, and you are basically presenting, you're painting a picture that leaves no hope for the people who are seeking justice. And what are they going to do? They're going to continue doing what they're doing. They're going to riot. They're going to cause trouble. Not because somebody's saying, hey, let's figure this out. Calm down, people. Figure this out. Hey, you know, we'll get to an end on this, you know, one way or the other. Figure it out first.
Okay.
No, well, you're not. You're stoking fires.
Okay. I'm going to let you go, and I'm going to see what response we have from other people. Thanks. Thanks for the call.
I was about to ask how many people think you are not part of the problem. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the call. 231-8187. We just had a caller who was saying, hey, look, this is problematic, I guess he's saying, and that this kid was from all the evidence, a bad dude, and he got blown away because he didn't behave in the appropriate way in a confrontation with a police officer. I don't agree, and in fact, I have no problem with labeling the shooting of an unarmed man who is not directly in confrontation, whatever happened a few minutes before. I have no problem in saying that that is murder. When I have a gun and I shoot somebody who doesn't have any kind of weapon, that's murder. Now, is it first-degree murder, second-degree murder, even third-degree murder? It's murder. I want to hear from you. Am I nuts, or is there really good reason to consider this a terrible crime against an individual? 231-8187. Ken, you're on the air.
I think it's me.
Hi, Ken.
Fair.
Pardon me?
Fair.
Oh, Pear, hi.
Hey, listen, I agree with you. That last caller, he does not know that Brown had a criminal mentality. I don't know where he gets that from. He doesn't know that. He's accusing him of that.
Yeah.
But the two items I wanted to bring up was, one is that the city of Ferguson, their second highest source of income are fines and court fees.
That's really?
That's where they make their money.
Huh.
And so, like, you can get a citation, and they have a weird way of scheduling court dates where a person can be 5 minutes late and be cited for failure to appear, which is a felony, I believe.
And the population is at least two-thirds African-American.
Exactly.
And the police department has three persons of color on it.
That's right. The population, they are mostly black, and they are mostly poor. So, this kind of court system can be really devastating.
Yeah, no, I understand the anger at my using the term murder, but I'm comfortable with it.
I am too.
Because, look, we got three witnesses. We got their testimony, their statements. We can see what happened. We have charts showing it. There's no police report, no incident report around what happened that could possibly explain the behavior of the policeman. And he's being invited to go to the grand jury that's going to discuss indicting him. Weird, absolutely weird situation.
Hey, the other news item is from USA Today.
Yeah.
The Missouri Ku Klux Klan is holding a fundraiser for the cop.
Cool. Thanks for the call, man.
Okay.
All right. Again, I am perfectly comfortable with what I have said. I am not at all questioning my judgment on this matter, even given that I was not there and did not directly see it. What is curious to me and what is scary to me is the way in which there's being constructed, even within the New York Times, a level of doubt such that the behavior of the policeman will be possibly, very possibly, exonerated. And there's been comment about why are people getting so angry? Why are they getting so angry? It's because the long history of repression by the police in the city of Ferguson. Again, I started earlier by pointing out that these tiny municipalities, their main source of revenue, as has been pointed out, is from tickets and fines, and that they don't have an overarching system of governance. The county government is not running most of the services. The mayor is elected in an election where there's very little or virtually no participation by the majority of the people in the community. It's a recipe for disaster, and now disaster has come. And yes, the officer might have been in a physical altercation. No, apparently he didn't get his eye socket broken. Yes, he was angry. Yes, his heart was racing. And yes, he pulled his gun. And yes, he shot an unarmed man from some distance. In fact, his shooting wasn't all that good. You know, one of his bullets went into a house. But he continued to shoot and continued to shoot. The person he shot went down. As he was going down, his head dropped, and then he was shot twice in the head. Come on, give us a break. 231-8187. Robert, you're on the air.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
You know, Americans don't like to be confused with the facts.
Okay.
You know, we do all kinds of things. You know, weapons of mass destruction, Kuwaiti princesses testifying to closed Senate hearings, and we go to war and kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people without establishing facts. So obviously, we're a great enough nation, we don't really need the facts. I'd just like to say that.
Well, that's depressing.
Joking.
Okay, is that it?
That's it. Bye.
Hey, thanks for the call. All right, I am apparently, I had no idea that this was the case, I am being so unfair in saying that shooting an unarmed man is murder. And it doesn't matter whether the guy has a badge on or not who does the shooting. Shooting an unarmed man is murder. It doesn't even matter if there'd been an altercation between the two of them previously. It doesn't even matter if the guy shot stole cigars, which may or may not be true. None of that is relevant to the excess force used to the murdering of an 18-year-old man. Okay, I want to hear from you. If you disagree or agree, give me a call. 231-8187 here at KBOO. I'm sorry, what name? Brent, you're on the air.
Hey, Joe, how you doing?
I'm okay.
Sounds like it. A couple of things real quick. The 3-minute rule should apply to some of those callers. You can figure out which.
Well, I've been real easy with that whole thing today.
I know. But, yeah, it seems that the courts decide the facts instead of the court of public opinion. And the way the media is set up now, people, they're set up to blur the facts, to push, like you said, with the New York Times. They're blurring. They create dissent, and that's really a frustrating thing to see over the last several years.
Well, you know, regarding the New York Times thing, it turns out that the public editor at the New York Times was very critical of these two articles that were on the front page of the paper on Wednesday. She essentially has said, this is bad journalism. There's no evidence for the other side. There's only, as an earlier caller called it, ghost witnesses. Whereas there are actually three direct witnesses to what happened.
Exactly.
Anyway, go ahead.
The way that those articles got in there, that inflames that whole situation.
Yeah.
The thing that springs to mind is that Eddie Murphy line from the first 48 hours when he goes into the bar and he says, I'm putting you down and keeping you down, and there's a new sheriff in town. That's what's been happening for so long, and that's what, when an event like this happens, that's what blows up. That people are just tired of it, and they reach their point of frustration.
Yeah, and I think it's very understandable that there were crowd responses.
But on both sides. the policeman overreacted.
Yeah.
And then the town overreacted.
Well, I was really shocked at the amount of force that was used against the demonstrators. It seemed like, both in terms of tactics, a bad approach, and in terms of the First Amendment, a bad approach. The idea, for example, that everybody should keep moving while they demonstrate. That's nonsense. People have a right under the Constitution to gather specifically at a specific spot to ask for redress of grievances. The police overreacted in so many ways. There was this weird incident, which, thank God, was interrupted by a reasonable police officer, where this one cop, we saw it on TV, went crazy. He was essentially threatening to shoot people and using the F word against people who were demonstrating. And fortunately, a higher up officer interrupted him, took him away from the scene, and now he has been temporarily suspended. He was out of control. He was more dangerous than anything else at that time. And the way in which this has all been handled is so insensitive and unreasonable and not respectful of the First Amendment. It's scary. It really is scary.
It is scary. It's that cult. There's a big cultural tipping point that feels like it just keeps getting closer and closer to this conflagration. And that's, you can just see it building and building and building.
Yeah, and it would be nice to say, oh, well, this is because of the peculiar situation of the city of Ferguson and the weirdness of the governments there. Well, that's all true. But the fact of the matter is that the number of African Americans both in prison and getting shot by police is horrendous and is not explainable by behavior per se. It's only explainable in terms of the tradition of American racism.
Exactly. It's like one black person every 28 minutes or something like that.
I don't know that.
I just heard that on a recent KBOO program.
Okay.
And a quick thing about Burning Man, mm-hmm. It's mostly a bunch of upper middle class white folks trying to out-cool each other.
I've never been there. I can't make a judgment about the festival itself. I like some of the images, but there's no question about how it's dependent upon and tolerates this incredible class division between the dot-com millionaires, billionaires really, and their elite setup with their Sherpas, that's you and I if we go there and go to work for these people, and their private kitchen and all that, and their special bathrooms and so on, and the way it is for ordinary folks there in the desert.
Right. I've been there 6 times.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 03 to 07, and then the last 2 years, but I'm not going this year.
Well, do you feel that I'm being unfair?
Well, it's pay to play. So if they want to bring all their RVs and all their kitchens and all that stuff, they can do that. There are still people going in their Subaru Justies with their tents and bicycle. So that's, there's a lot of those people as well.
Yeah, and I have to say, aesthetically and politically, I think Burning Man is very cool overall.
It's super cool, but from the class perspective, it is a bunch of upper middle class white folks because it's an expensive event to attend.
Yeah, and then there's these super rich people who have their compound.
Right. Oh, yeah.
I mean, they actually line up their RVs, as I understand it. Now, you've been there. I haven't.
Line the wagons in a circle, and they have their little area.
Right, exactly. And they have their Sherpas.
Yep.
Which is a kind of racist thing anyway, but what we're talking about is ordinary people earning some money by serving the rich.
Right.
Okay, anyway, thanks for the call, man. 231-8187. Am I just about out of time? We have time for one more call? Richard, you're on the air. Richard?
Well,
go ahead.
There's a new outfit called the National Liberty Alliance that would bring what you're looking for, and that is the findings of fact. At least the last few people have talked about, we need to find the facts. And the National Liberty Alliance is a grand jury movement across the nation. And I think that without having a legitimate, an alternative to the traditional grand jury or the conventional grand jury that's has a ring in their nose that is led around by the DA, we're not going to get any further than we are, whether it's a year from now or 5 years from now. We need to have traditional constitutional grand juries reinstated in every county, and the National Liberty Alliance, which is searchable by National Liberty Alliance, offers that.
Well, I have to say I know nothing about it, but it's an interesting idea, and I appreciate your call.
No, that's why I'm bringing it up. It's a little-known, talked-about thing, but it is a national thing, and there are 49 states now that have grand juries signed up. Oregon's working on it, and I think if everybody signed up, if everybody took responsibility for making findings of fact, doing deliberations, then we'd have a lot better society. We wouldn't have to jump up and down and say, he did it, no, she did it.
Okay.
It can't have been done that way.
That's very
Liberty Alliance.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I will look into that. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to end the show now. This is Joe Uris. This is Positively Revolting, and I'm just sitting in here for the two women who run the show. They'll be back in, what, a couple of weeks? All right, this is KBOO, 90.7 FM dial. You should stick around because it's a great station doing great music and great news and public affairs.
No worries about nothing, just getting good.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor La Peña Flamenca de Portland on Friday, August 22nd. This month, co-sponsor La Peña Flamenca de Portland presents El Cuadro Gallo. Featuring Christina Lawrence, accompanied by Jeffrey Trapp on guitar, Paul Brady on cante, Nick Hutch on cajon, and Brenna McDonald on palmas. Again, that's La Peña Flamenca de Portland and El Cuadro Gallo on Friday, August 22nd at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good people, we at Guess Who's Coming to Radio are back with our annual celebration.